Welcome, everyone, to the AI and Business Podcast. I'm Matthew DeMello, Senior Editor here at Emerge Technology Research. Today's guest is Alan Boehm, former Chief Technology Officer at H&M, though at the time of this recording, he was still present in that position. Alan also has served at a number of Fortune 500 companies, assisting them through their digital transformations, including Coca-Cola and Procter & Gamble. Alan returns to the program today to discuss his pet peeves regarding the quote-unquote enterprise deep state, or what he sees as those forces inside the modern-day American corporation that enforce a status quo that will always keep an organization from its true innovative potential. Later, he explains why AI capabilities will help reveal the deep state inside every organization, hopefully rendering them a permanent place in the history books. Without further ado, here's our conversation. Alan, thanks so much for being with us again on the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So we're here to talk about a white paper that you've been developing that I think has some really, really incredible, if controversial, ideas. I know you've talked about this in retail conferences, but I think this is really going to, at least for our audience, help shape how to think about corporations, how to think about the onset of the AI age that we're living in right now. And the title of this white paper is The Armada of Deep Enterprise. And of course, that's pulling from the U.S. conspiracy theory of the deep state, where that's as much as it has to do with it. It doesn't go anymore. The commonalities stop there. But you talk about the dangers in this white paper of the deep enterprise, echoing the deep state criticism of our politics, in that there are parts of the government, or the corporation in this case, that are unaccountable. They've been there forever, and they're hard to hold accountable or even get rid of. Your white paper even talks about an enterprise police state that exists in a lot of legacy firms. Tell us about the challenges of what you describe as the deep enterprise and why this is such a quiet problem for business leaders in these last few decades.
Well, you know, I've worked for multiple companies across multiple industries, and this isn't a retail thing. This really is what I have been part of, what I have observed for over 25 years. And this has to do with what impedes innovation, impedes what I will call major leaps forward for corporations, because corporations are built in order to mimic a machine. They're built to be repeatable and have repeatable processes and policies that really don't challenge the status quo other than on an incremental basis. And that's why it's so interesting and so easy many times for companies that are startups that know nothing about a given industry, whether it's Uber taking on the taxi industry, whether it's SpaceX taking on the aerospace and the space industry. And there's just so many more examples, is that they don't play by the same rules. They're not bound by the same historic knowledge. They're not bound by these old policies, which are meant to protect people's roles and people's jobs in a company. And that's right. The problem about missing out on innovation is that companies are set up not to change. They're set up to ensure that they will consistently produce what they've done for the last 50, 100 years. And individuals are doing everything they can to maintain that. And there's other individuals are doing everything they can to report on people that are trying to challenge that because they feel challenged and don't understand where the future is going.
Of course.
And that's the concept of deep state and police state.
It makes sense to me. I mean, the last company I worked for, I won't mention them in this context. People can dig into the our podcast history to nail them down. I've nothing bad to say about them. I would only point out that I've seen the moment in terms of when a startup goes from like 120 employees to these systems and the status quo mentality being in place over a period of time. In what point in your mind, in terms of the typical corporate life cycle of a company going from, you know, startup to legacy, at what point do management strategies turn from developing innovation to conducting surveillance on innovative processes, as you describe it in the white paper?
Well, I don't think that the companies or the leadership actually intends to put in this observations. I don't believe it. I think that this is, and this gets back into this, the behavior. People are worried about their jobs. People want consistency. They don't like change, and they take it on themselves. and they end up managing and measuring themselves based on the incremental improvements that they're making to what they've done for the last 20, 25 years. It's human nature at the end of the day to resist change in many cases. Mm-hmm. And I think I've been at corporations that are large, some very, very large ones. I've been at some that are very small. And what's interesting is it's the leaders. It gets down to that leadership. I worked for a company that in its heyday, it was the Fortune 1 company of the world.
Right.
And it was interesting to see the CEO of that company really personally drive the change. I don't believe if he would not have stood up one day and said, I need to make this happen for my company for the future. And he challenged his direct reports and said, you need to make it happen. It never would have happened if it was left to other people in the company. And that leader who made that decision to go outside and bring talent in during the web heyday was Jack Welch.
Interesting.
And Jack was known for many things, but Jack also knew that he needed to be able to position himself better in the future than where he ever was.
And it's interesting that you mention that in terms of contingent labor, because the white paper also mentions that contingent labor is a significant factor in letting enterprise deep states get too powerful. Where do you see that difference in terms of that being the case?
Well, I think what happens is, and I had an interesting talk with a friend yesterday, is that many people inside corporations, they're very good at managing projects, very good at managing budgets, they understand the policies. But when it comes down to these skill sets, especially when you're talking about new technologically driven change, they don't necessarily have the skill sets or the knowledge to understand what the implications of this are. So they have to reach out to third parties in order to do the pragmatic implementation to get them going. And therefore, you end up in this cycle of relying on third parties to take these giant steps forward, or many times just some of the simple leaps forward, because it's okay for an outside party to challenge the status quo because they're going to be there for as long as their contract is. But it's not okay for the employee who's worried about that next promotion, who's worried about what's going to happen next. The challenge when you start going to the same third parties that your competitors use and everybody else uses, you're getting best practices brought in. And everyone thinks best practices is this great thing to have. Well, it is if you want to commoditize something, because as soon as everybody is using the best practice, it becomes a commodity and you have no longer have a competitive advantage. So how do you become disruptive and have a sustainable competitive advantage if you're using the techniques and things that everybody else is using? And that's why we get addicted in many cases to relying on the third parties to get things done. The third parties play a role. They play a very important role to move things forward, but corporations also need to provide that safe landing zone, that psychological safety for their employees to step out and show what they can do independently, not necessarily just relying on a third party.
Right, right. And I know this from experience, just in terms of like even startups going from that, you know, 100 employee range to that 300 employee range, the relationship. I mean, there's social science on this. Anybody who's read Malcolm Gladwell knows the 150 rule. You know, the relationships with individuals just change at that point. And then the standards in terms of we need to make everything the same for everybody, best practices, best practices, best practices. That's when that cement really starts to harden. I want to even take a step back here, because I think it is time to throw some bombs and name some names. What do you see as the divisions of the typical corporate firm structure that reinforce the worst attributes of the enterprise deep state as you see it in your view?
Well, I mean, over time, where I've seen that the most difficulty is it gets down to people and money at the end of the day, yeah. Right? At the end of the day, that's where it is. And I've seen many HR organizations, which are HR organizations, they're chasing policies, they're chasing procedures, they are looking at trying to get everything to fit into a predetermined model. And I would say they're HR organizations, they're not people organizations.
Right.
And if you're a people organization, you care about the people, you care about what the people contribute to the bottom line, you care about how that's going to get done, as opposed to measuring the number of employees you have, the number of contractors you have, what's the productivity level. All of that's important, but that's more machine-like. That is not people. And having a real people executive that puts the people first is paramount to change. If you don't have that, and you're running on a old traditional HR organization, you're going to have problems. The second area that we get into trouble with all the time when you're trying to drive innovation is a procurement or a purchasing organization, because they are more comfortable working with traditional firms they've had longstanding relationships with that understand what indemnification clauses are, that understand, hey, I want these extended payment terms. Okay, I'm going to mark the price up another 5% to cover your extended payment term. Well, that's okay because I'm getting measured on getting an extended payment term, not necessarily on the fact that you've marked the price up by 5%. I don't realize it. But these companies end up putting these procurement processes in place that are meant for very large, full-scale operations, which are good if you're buying large amounts of chemicals or you're buying transportation contracts or things of that nature. But when you want to work with innovative people and entrepreneurs, you need to level the playing field and put things in place that encourage speed, encourage a risk-taking, but in a very much in a measurable way, because you're never going to put your company at risk. But it's about speed. It's about moving forward. It's about transferring knowledge equally back and forth so that they can build businesses and you can build businesses. So the procurement organizations I've seen over and over again stop or slow down the opportunity to make these big leaps forward. And that goes hand in hand with legal, because legal ends up wanting to put in these contracts to protect the corporation, mm-hmm. which is, that's fine. But to me, legal's role really should be enabling the corporation in a safe way to do business. It shouldn't be coming up with all the different ways to actually slow things down because we're trying to cross every T and dot every I that's possible. Again, there has to be some risk that you're willing to take as a company if you want to move forward.
I got a couple follow-ups based on that last answer because there's a lot to pull apart from there. But let me start with where you just left off at procurement and legal, specifically legal. Just in terms of, you know, I'm sure we got a lot of people listening to the show who goes, okay, Alan, I get it. You know, there are corporations get big and slow, they turn into aircraft carriers. All at the same time, is risk aversion so bad a thing? Is that separate, you know, from what you're talking about? Shouldn't legal departments be ultimately defensive? Or is what you're saying, we need a total change of mentality and we need to let go of that kind of goalie syndrome with a lot of these departments?
Well, and I think I'm going to answer this question. I've worked for privately held and publicly held corporations, and you do get a different attitude at each.
Yeah.
Privately held are willing to take a little more risk. The publicly held, everything is couched in. We have to protect the shareholders and et cetera. I think, though, and I'll give it a real example from many years ago when I was at a company that was privately held at the time. We wanted to change the risk factor. The project that we were working on at the time said that you had to have a multi-piece airway bill with live signatures in order to ship, to make a shipment. And I wanted to put everything on a sticker. And ended up, the problem was the shipments were protected by what's called the Warsaw Convention. The Warsaw Convention Yep. limited the liability of the carriers in the shipment of goods. So I went ahead and looked at that. And all it said was it had to have a signature and a replication of a signature. Because in those days, when this thing was put together in the 30s, they had carbon paper. Probably 90% of the listeners don't even know what carbon paper is, but they have carbon paper back then. And therefore, legal was saying, well, no, you have to have an actual signature with carbon paper. I went out to outside counsel and said, I want to get an interpretation of this. And I got an interpretation, and the counsel says, well, yes, it says that, but at the time the law was written, nobody actually had thought of printers or computers or anything else. They were dealing with typewriters and things. Mm-hmm. So it got down to the key question was, could we eliminate 7 steps in a supply chain process by moving to a sticker? And would we still have the protections that we need? Or were we going to be inefficient forever because we had to be on this 6-part airway bill? And end of the day, we ended up in a room and internal legal counsel was very specific. No, it has to be signatures, actual signatures and replications. And we had this discussion. We had finance in there, the CFO. And finally, the COO stood up and said, this is not your decision. This is a business risk. Since this is a business risk, I am the one that's responsible for this risk in this company. I've weighed what you said, and I believe that the risk is not greater than the progress that we're going to make in moving forward and changing how we digitize this company. And that's how the company was able to get from 6 parts down to a sticker and be able to start shipping in 70 countries, eliminating all these process steps, driving margin up, and making it easier for the consumer to do business with us.
I loved the specificity of your answer. I mentioned that I had a couple of follow-ups from that last one. I'll say this. Our last two conversations make me very, very grateful for being born in 1987. Just old enough to know what carbon paper is and know a time before the internet. Just young enough to be on TikTok and not, I guess, a total loser. Anyway, but you brought up, you were hammering a bit on our friends in HR, and you were offering, you know, an alternative of a pro-people organization. I'm wondering if we can cite a more specific answer or example for a pro-people company policy as opposed to what we have in HR that dampens or holds back innovation.
Well, I mean, this one is sort of HR related, but it's also finance related.
Sure.
And it's something that I experienced a while back. But for years, people would have to do expense reports. I don't know, maybe the company you're working with, you still do expense reports today, and you fill out a form, you attach receipts, you enter everything into the system, and then hopefully you get paid, right? I mean, that's right. How it works. But to me, that means, do you trust your employee? Because what you're basically saying is I'm going to validate everything that you do before I give it to you, as opposed to, look, I followed company policy. I only spent X amount for dinner. I only spent X amount for the hotel. I booked through the travel agent. Why do you even need to go through and audit all of that?
Right.
Trust your employee first. And then you can, if you suspect something, then you can do things by an exception basis. But why put the entire organization through, do you trust and verify, or do you verify and trust? And to me, a people organization trusts first and then verifies. It doesn't go through verification all over the board and then trust at the end. And there's too many companies that still verify and trust and don't trust and verify. Why would you hire the person to begin with if you didn't trust them?
Reagan-esque, I'll call it that. Although the phrase trust and verify actually comes from Soviet propaganda. People don't realize that because they always connect it with Reagan. I'll leave the political commentary there because we're getting to my favorite part of the discussion. Hopefully we have enough time to really pull this apart. But given your experience in leading enterprise AI adoptions, you did this at Procter & Gamble, Coca-Cola, most recently at H&M. What do you see as the attributes of the enterprise deep state that you hope will be a thing of the past, say in 10 years, thanks to the developments that we're seeing in AI right now?
Well, I think that especially when you look at the LLM models and what's happening here, is that much of this work that has been done by human beings that are repetitive are going to be replaced. And you're seeing the research that's being done by legal departments can be done through AI. A lot of the call center and that type of information is going to be done through AI. So a lot of these opportunities where the deep state has come in and put in processes and policies to make sure things don't change are going to be questioned, because you're going to be able to correlate the information for the first time and actually show the value of breaking up the deep state and breaking up the police state and getting it back to where the individual is actually the one that is providing the value. The creative person will be rewarded in the future. That's going to all change here as soon as we have these models replace all of these people that are doing these mundane, repetitive tasks that are part of the deep state today.
And just to even take it right back to your last answer about verify but trust, why trust but verify? Why do it the opposite way? Why you know, harangue everybody for how they spent company expenses if you have hard data on who the bad guys are, who are the bad employees, who actually abuses the system? And if you have hard numbers about how small that number is or how that behavior actually occurs, then there's absolutely no need to force everybody in the organization to go through that process. So very, very straight line right there. But in terms of, you know, the practical, you know, actionable insight that, you know, the listeners at home can kind of take home, at least from how we've been framing the discussion, what advice do you have for those, you know, facing down, you know, the antipathy to innovation and change, you know, particularly, you know, maybe from the higher end in management? If you're working within an enterprise, what are the best strategies? I won't say best practices. I know I know they're a little bit of the enemy in this conversation, but what are the best strategies you've found for trying to break that ice in getting management to see the benefits of change and go after this enterprise deep state?
Well, I'm going to give you just sort of a general principle for first, and then we're going to jump into that. And the principle is loosely related to the book Animal Farm. So we'll
Love
go
it.
There for a second.
Yeah, let's do it.
So to sort of paraphrase Animal Farm, you know, in there it says, everyone is created equal, but it's sometimes some people are more equal than others. Now, of course, they were talking about animals, but that's it. But we have to really think about that when we're in a corporation. And when we understand that at a given point in time, certain skill sets or certain things must be attacked and must be challenged very quickly, we need to do everything possible to go in and clear the space so that we don't treat everything equal. There's only so much money that's ever budgeted or available, or so much capital investment that's available. But you're not going to get the same return out of that money or the time you invest, whether it's HR or legal this year or supply chain. Two or three things are always going to be most important. And what you want to do because middle management is going to try to stop everything the best that it can because it wants to control it. Senior management is looking at the numbers that it has to hit. What I find works best is to partner up with people that actually have revenue responsibility, like a salesperson or a merchandiser that has certain responsibility. And if you can make the people that are actually in the field working with the customers on a day-to-day basis successful, and they can, ends up putting some money in the company's pocket, more money in their pocket in the case of a salesperson, all of a sudden you get a network effect because everybody wants to know why John or Sue or whoever it might be is moving faster with their customers than anybody else. So I find it to be a bottom-up approach that is fully engaging with decision makers that allows this to happen on a basis of scale that you can't imagine. We at many of the companies I've been with have done this in different parts of the world. We did this in Vietnam in one company because we said, you know what? It's a risk. If it doesn't work, it won't show up in the Wall Street Journal because we're doing it in Vietnam if we fail with this. We've done it sometimes in major cities because we wanted to get the publicity about being there first and the value to the brand of being innovative. But if you don't innovate and you don't move things forward and you don't take those risks and you don't engage everybody, you'll never get it done. Innovation doesn't happen top down, but the CEO or a senior executive must support the innovation, and they must have enough confidence in their abilities to fight through any potential problems in order to get there. Otherwise, it won't succeed.
I love so much in your answer right there, and emerges heartily. You know, we're a very strong team of like double digit folks. I'm very proud of this team. But part of our practice is here that I think lend itself to your last answer is, you know, like a lot of companies with like maybe, you know, kind of a face saving HR department. We do not describe ourselves as this company is not a family. Like, no, I'm not your dad. I'm not your brother. I care about you and I want to make sure you're okay. You want to have like, you know, deep-seated therapy conversations? Absolutely. I'll break down those walls. I'm an open book. But I always say, you know, for Emerge, we're a band. And because when you're in a band, you realize that not every role is equal. But if the lead singer treats the drummer like he's a janitor, he's not going to be playing with the drummer for very long. And there's not very much of a band. So, you know, I think in terms of trying to realize our hierarchies where they are and where they're actually justified, and also that you still can't have a band out of just one person, you know, and really valuing all of the things that put somebody in the spotlight, you know, front row, center, all of the backstage folks, if I can expand the metaphor to theater. But we're getting a little outside the corporate territory, so I'll leave it there. Alan, very, very fascinating stuff. We'll have to point people straight towards the white paper. Thank you so much for being with us these past two episodes. It's been some really mind-blowing stuff.
I appreciate it. I look forward to staying in touch, and thank you for having me once again. Take care.
Absolutely. You're part of the band.
Thank you.
You know, wrapping up today's episode, I knew this was going to be controversial when Alan first pitched it. That said, we have no fear of controversy here on the AI and Business Podcast. We are big fans of takes that are thought-provoking. And all that said, I think a lot of enterprise listeners here are all aware that modern-day corporations are a retainer of the status quo in many ways. I'm not sure Alan's advice will, if enacted overnight, make them as nimble as startups, but I do feel like a lot of what he said today tells us a lot about how AI-driven insights can be the start of a conversation about more common sense policies that don't punish everyone for a few bad apples. After all, if we have data that says exactly how many bad apples there are, we can curtail our policies to fit them and only them, instead of putting the entire organization through manual processes that slow everybody down. And I think that example from expense reports that Alan brought up was a really great example, but we may see this engulf entire departments, HR among them, as Alan explained throughout today's show. On behalf of Daniel and the entire team here at Emerge, thanks so much for joining us today, and we'll catch you next time on the AI in Business podcast.